Before we get started with this week's episode, we'd like to remind you folks that the Air Raid podcast is available at many places, including iTunes, the Stitcher Radio app for your smart device, CairoRadio.com, and the all-new Adore Network at Adore.fm. Let's get started with the episode. Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 296 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. We've got a great show planned for you this week. A good friend of mine, Greg Vandy from KEXP, he hosts the Roadhouse on KEXP. Wonderful station. Wonderful show that he does on the radio, on the terrestrial radio. And he's going to be in here because he just wrote this amazing book about Woody Guthrie's days, a one-month period in Woody Guthrie's life where he was writing songs actually for the government. And if you know anything about Woody Guthrie, that is not a normal thing that Woody Guthrie would have done. But he believed in this project so much, which was going to bring power to the Columbia River Basin and to basically the whole west coast of Washington and Oregon, by building a giant dam, the Grand Coulee Dam, in the Columbia River. And it's a fascinating story, really, really cool to kind of find out, like, how this all came to be, man. This is, like, why I am able to talk to you guys right now, right? This is one of the big reasons, because of electricity, right? Yeah, so Woody Guthrie was a part of that. The government hired him to write songs, 26 songs, in 30 days for this project, and it was basically propaganda. Propaganda for the greater good, and that's why Woody Guthrie, of course, somebody who definitely stood against the establishment, chose to do this. Coming up, we're talking with Greg Vandy, the writer of this new book, 26 Songs in 30 Days, Woody Guthrie's Columbia River Songs in the Planned Promised Land in the Pacific Northwest. Great stuff, man. I did not have a chance to get started reading this book when Greg Vandy came in, so I didn't know much about this story, but just hearing Greg talk about this, you get a keen sense as to how interested in the topic he is. And I talked to Greg when he was about halfway through this book, and I was super interested about it. And I said, when you finish this, let's do a chat. And of course, you know, his PR team reached out, and we got it going. So it's going to be an interesting one, folks. So I have had a chance to read some of the book now, although I still haven't finished it, and it is fascinating. It's fascinating to learn about the history of what brings or what brought power to the West, man. It's a really great story. So I suggest that you go out and check it out. You can go to SasquatchBooks.com and order it from there. It's also available on Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, and at Powell's Books. Once again, the name of the book is 26 Songs in 30 Days. And highly, highly suggest it. It's great. And we're going to be featuring songs from Woody Guthrie from his Columbia River song. So get ready for that, man. And some of these songs are very, very old. So they're not the best quality. They're not the highest fidelity, okay? So bear with us on that one. Go to SasquatchBooks.com. Get yourself a copy of Greg Vandy's new book, 26 Songs in 30 Days. They're also doing a great little get-together over at Grand Coulee Dam. It's a free event on Saturday, May 28th, celebrating the 75th anniversary of Woody Guthrie's Columbia River Songs, 1941 to 2016, man. Hosted and curated by KEXP's Greg Vandy, put on by our friends at Artist Home. And it's a free event over at Grand Coulee Dam on Saturday, May 28th. So if you're in the Washington area or maybe just in Oregon, Eastern Oregon, yeah, go out and check this out. It's going to be a lot of fun, man. And very interesting. You'll learn some history, man, of the great Northwest, okay? All right. We've got a couple of things to get to here before we get started. We got a great email from longtime listener to the Air Raid podcast, Jordan from Portland, Oregon. And he writes in, and this is, I don't know if Jordan knew that I needed to hear something like this, but I definitely did. So I want to read this for you guys. And it's a bit serious of an email. He starts out, "Hey man, so right now I'm a few episodes behind on the podcast because of baseball. Sorry about that. Anyways, I just wanted to say that I'm thinking about you through everything that is happening to you. I care about you, and I only hope for the best for you, and I hope you can make it through this hard time. I know that there are plenty of people that deeply care. I also want to say another thing. Recently, I've been battling a lot of anxiety and depression, something I always have had throughout my entire life. I got to a really, really bad place lately. I'm getting to a better place right now, and I want to say thank you for helping me with that. Music has always been a big part of my life, but it stopped because I became so full of panic and dread and self-loathing over the fact that I never knew enough and jealous of people that did. But thanks to the meds mainly, I'm finally enjoying it again and giving zero fucks about that dread before. And thank you for your podcast. I'm able to finally love it again and loving the job you do with the interviews. I mean, I'm definitely going to check out more of 764 Hero and IG88. I guess to sum it up, even though I don't know you personally, you are a huge part of my life and helping me become a real life fucking human being. I care about you and want everything to go well for you through these tribulations. You are a great person. Thank you for everything. Cheers, Jordan." Man, yes, we are going through some pretty heavy shit here at the Roden household, and this email was definitely something that I needed to hear right at that time. And I'm very sorry, Jordan, that you're going through the depression and the anxiety. I have been there. It's rough, dude. It's really rough. And I hope you have a good support system. And you know, if you ever need to email me, you can, dude. Anytime, man. I will do my best to get back to you in a quick fashion. And yeah, I would love to, you know, keep up correspondence with you on this, buddy. I hope that you're doing well, and I know that it can be a really rough road, but what helps the most, and this is what I've found, is that you talk to a loved one about it, you talk to a friend about it, you know, what's going on, or you just talk to a therapist about it. You know, a lot of the times when you get stuck in this spiral of anxiety and depression like I do, you don't want to talk about it. You don't feel like it matters. You don't feel like people will be perceptive to it or receptive to it, I should say. But it really, really helps to just talk about it and get it out. And you'll be amazed at how much of a weight is lifted off your shoulders when you do that. So, Jordan, thank you so much for listening over the years. It's great to have you, man, and I really needed to hear that because I was going through a little bit of a rough spot myself. So hearing how big of a part this podcast has become in your life is just fills me with joy, and I hope you feel that joy as well. So we'll continue to make these great podcasts and have these great interviews for you, buddy. And yeah, I want you to be well, okay? All right. Let's see. On to Facebook. Nick Kennedy writes on our Facebook page, which you can do as well by going to facebook.com/the Air Raid Podcast. You can follow us on there, and our doings on Facebook, and we would really appreciate that, of course. Let's see, Nick Kennedy, listening to the Lyrics Born episode, writes in, speaking as an ill-informed white guy who has never heard Lyrics Born before, that interview was one of my favorites. That dude is fucking fascinating. Fun music, too. Thank you so much, Nick. That's awesome. That's awesome. Nick also goes by the name of Nargle Fargle, I think, right? Is that the right one? Nargle Fargle? I don't know. I don't know what that is. I don't know what it means. But that's what Nick has. It's some sort of like second identity for Nick there, right? Mike Sains of the Tower of Sour podcast. We've known Mike for a long time. He writes in, this is amazing. Thanks so much, Mike. I'm glad you really enjoyed it, man. That on the Lyrics Born episode. If you haven't listened to it yet, please go back and download that episode because it is awesome. And we've got a live performance by Lyrics Born, and it was a real treat to have him here in studio for that live performance and very candid conversation on his origins in the hip-hop world. And also, you know, got pretty serious talking about his ethnicity and how that played into, you know, getting a record contract and you know, all that stuff that goes along with the entertainment industry. So I thought that was a great chat, and I think you will too if you haven't heard it yet. Okay, let's go with this, shall we? Let's do our first musical break. We're featuring music by Woody Guthrie off of, let's see, these 26 songs that he wrote in 30 days. Let's see, this one's called Roll On, Columbia, Roll On. And like I said before, it is an old, old song, and this is off of a vinyl, a very old vinyl, and I think you'll be able to hear that. So the fidelity is not the highest, folks. So bear with us on that. Roll On, Columbia, Roll On by Woody Guthrie. And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears. Stay with us.
Yakky Maw Snake and the Clicky Tattoo. Sandy Willamette and Hood River too. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. It's there on your banks that we fought many a fight. Sheridan's boys and the blockhouse that night. They saw us in death, but never in flight. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Your power is turning our darkness to dawn. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Our loved ones we lost there at Cole's little store by fireball and rifle a dozen or more. We won, but the Marion soldier she bore. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Remember the trial when the battle was won. The wild Indian warriors to the tall timber run. We hung ever ending with smoke in his gun. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Year after year we had tedious trials, fighting the rapids and cascades and downs. The engines rest peaceful on Mamaloo Sound. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Your power is turning our darkness to dawn. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. At Bonneville now there is ships in the locks. Waters have arisen and drowned at the rocks. Shiploads of plenty will steam in the docks. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. On up the river at Grand Coulee Dam, mightiest thing ever built by a man, to run the great factories for old Uncle Sam. Let's roll on, Columbia, roll on.
I like it. I like it. I think it fits.
Feel like a Colin show.
I think it fits. Yeah. I think it fits, man. So do you ever? You told me once that when we were talking,
it's
like
good
a,
seeing you again.
Long,
I like
it's
you.
Good to
it's
see you
good
again
seeing
too.
You. It was really fun hanging out.
We had a great time last
great
summer.
Great time,
too,
man. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
A little vape pen going on.
Yeah.
I mean, that was fun.
I have a child now. I can't get high anymore. It's hard enough Raising a 10-week-old, you know, you have to get up every 2 hours. If you,
that just sounds so terrible. It's like I got a kid now. I can't get high.
If you get high, you cannot get up very easily.
No.
But when you have a child, you must get up.
Right.
So why make it even worse?
Well, see, yours is, I mean, you're just starting out. Like, you're just starting out on this. Your journey is just beginning.
Yeah.
Like, once they get to this age, you can be high all the time.
Right.
And actually, it helps.
True dat.
Parenting 101 with the Air Raid Podcast. You know how many angry emails I'm going to get for that one? Yeah, probably a lot.
My wife's not listening, is she?
I don't know. Not right now.
Jana?
Yeah, maybe in the future.
Right.
Yeah, she could be. Be careful.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be kind of revealing to hear this when, you know, 10 years from now on some, you know, from streaming from some cloud somewhere, they discover the show. My wife hears my,
you know. Right, right. Just somewhere in the distant future.
Yeah, my wife.
This will be archived. The aliens will find it. It'll be like an AI situation.
And then my wife's like, what? You're getting high? You have a child.
In your 60s. Oh, and then getting in trouble for something you said, you know, 40 years ago.
You know, people are pretty cavalier about things they've put out there, right?
Pretty much.
You know, that whole thing of it coming back to bite people is going to be really prevalent, I feel.
Do you think so?
I think so.
Well, I mean, it's already started. Like, you know, people posting stuff on Facebook or, like, you know, pictures or, you know, things like that, Snapchat.
Yeah.
Things always come back to bite people on Snapchat.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're ever putting a picture out of your genitalia, I mean, you should expect that somebody's saving it.
Yeah. Well, it's been proven that Snapchat doesn't actually disappear like it's advertised. Like,
no.
It's actually recorded or imprinted somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And then shows up, you know, in a job interview.
Yeah. At the worst possible time.
Worst possible time.
Did you know that Drew Christie did this illustration? Do you know Drew Christie? You should have him on your show.
Drew Christie?
Drew Christie is an animator, illustrator, genius.
Really?
Yeah. And he's also an actor. And
He did this picture of Washington. We're talking about your book, 26 Songs in 30 Days. Greg Vandy joining me here in the backyard. It's a book about basically Woody Guthrie's Columbia River songs that he got what? Paid to do for what, the building of the Grand Coulee Dam? Is that how?
No, it's not like that.
No, not at all. Okay.
You've missed it.
Okay, so
but it is kind of like that though.
Okay,
he did get paid.
I did not read this book.
I understand.
I told you why.
Yeah.
Earlier, it was a good reason.
Yeah.
And so you're gonna have to bear with me here.
No problem.
Woody Guthrie was born in 2018. And he sang for the band Goldfinch, correct?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, that's not right. the book has to do with Woody Guthrie when he wrote these songs for the Bonneville Power Administration back in 1941.
Yes.
So he was a commissioned songwriter for the federal government to provide songs for this documentary film the BPA was trying to make in 41 to sort of advertise or to promote the benefits of these public works projects like the Grand Coulee Dam and the Bonneville Dam, and also the other benefits of those projects, which was mass irrigation of the Columbia Basin, which at that time was completely a dry desert area.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so it was basically government propaganda.
It's exactly that.
Yeah.
But it's propaganda that one can believe in.
Well, sure, yeah, you know, bringing power to the Great Northwest.
Right, you know, I mean, we kind of touch upon that in the book, and where there's a quote from a new dealer, a government official from the from FDR's administration that says, well, you know, the common regular people need propaganda too, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we call private interest propaganda advertising, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Who's advertising for the, you know, for the public? And so this project in the New Deal administrator's eyes was advertising for something that would benefit people.
Yeah, yeah. And that's super interesting. Is that part of the reason why you wanted to do this? Because, I mean, Woody Guthrie, you wouldn't think that Woody Guthrie, being who he was, would be somebody who would be into doing something that had anything to do with propaganda. Yeah.
Well, we touched upon that in the book. You know, mm-hmm. In the preface, we sort of we make it pretty clear that Woody Guthrie was into this project and that it was something that he did believe in, and that you know, it wasn't like shilling for something. It was actually something that he was behind and supported and was you know, happy to be a part of. It was sort of a patriotic effort for the guy, you know, a guy who wasn't known to be patriotic, or a guy who wasn't really structured in his life, and he was able to find structure and purpose for 1 month and wrote some of his best songs ever. Some of his best material was produced during this 1 month in Portland.
Yeah, yeah.
Songs like Pastures of Plenty, Grand Coulee Dam, Hard Traveling. These were all Columbia River songs that
really
went on to sort of, you know, greater meaning and greater purpose after the project, you know, as sort of his best songs. But they're originally written in Portland for this project.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
It is.
And so this the Columbia River Basin, of course, cuts through the southern border of Washington, the northern border of Oregon. And so this project was going to bring power to Oregon and Washington then.
Yeah. So it was a federal program.
Yeah.
The BPA is a federal agency, so it touched upon...
Does it still exist?
Yeah, it does. It's very much a different agency, but the original intention of the agency was to market and provide the power from Grand Coulee and Bonneville to people. You know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The dam, the Grand Coulee is owned by the Bureau of Reclamation, and the Bonneville Dam is owned by the Army Corps of Engineers.
Right.
They own and run the dams, but marketing and selling the power is the responsibility of the BPA.
Oh, okay.
To this
day,
yeah.
I did some work out at the Bonneville Dam in college.
Did you?
Yeah, I would watch 16-hour long videotapes of the fish ladder and count the fish that were swimming through.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great job for a college student.
I bet.
Because it was basically, you just watch these things on fast forward, and every time you see a blip go by, you press pause, you bring it back a little bit, and you see what kind of fish it is, and then you take a tally.
Sounds like a perfect job for you.
It was. I kind of want that job back.
Who doesn't?
Oh, man. Yeah. I didn't lie at that job. I tried not to, anyway.
No one said you did. I'm not sure where you're going with
that. Well, I just wanted to make that clear. May have lied about how many hours I worked, but you know, it was through the school.
Yeah,
it's through the biology department, so it was fine. They have a lot of money. It's good.
A lot of the book, you know, we in the preface, we sort of have to say we're not dam lovers, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, there is a lot to say about damming a wonderful wild river. You know, there was a lot of, you know, collateral damage, obviously. There was environmental, you know, disasters. And
Oh, sure.
You know, the treatment of Native Americans was just, you know, abysmal. You know, they were not considered. And, you know, the loss of salmon is a reality, you know. But you really cannot deny that Western cities like Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, none of these cities would exist without, you know, damming rivers. You know, the Western cities, they owe their power needs to dams. So,
oh, sure.
You really can't be intellectually honest by saying that dams are all good or dams are all bad.
Right, right.
So
definitely.
In the book, we try to say, what was the original intention of these projects?
Was there an outcry when this was all going on? I would imagine that the outcry would be fairly muffled. But was there an outcry when the government came in and started taking the native lands from the reservations?
Yeah, there was, but nobody listened.
Nobody listened to that.
I mean, you know, you can imagine that, you know, our sensibilities were different in late 1930s, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Really, I mean, when you look at it, if you were not a white male, you were not considered for many things, you know.
Sure.
So a lot of the things we discovered in the book was that this period of the 1930s, the sort of New Deal for America, was all about a reforming and a re-identification of what America really is. And so the people who were on the left wing of the political spectrum, from just simple liberals to progressives to Communist Party members, were into the idea that, you know, that America could and should be more inclusive.
Yeah.
So if you were a woman, a Black American, a Native American, a Jew, you were not considered to be, you know,
yeah,
on the same level as a white male. So a lot of the decisions were made without considering, you know,
yeah,
minority interests.
Yeah, and it was just a big land grab, basically. Big eminent domain is what they would call it.
Yeah, pretty much. But on the other hand, you know, the idea was to provide sort of this, you know, it was dubbed the Planned Promised Land because it was an idea to create usable farmland for people who were displaced by the Dust Bowl, which is ironic because, you know, Woody Guthrie is, you know, very much a symbol of the Dust Bowl. He, uh-huh. His Dust Bowl ballads are written 1 year before the Columbia River songs.
Yeah.
So for him, this idea of reclaiming land and irrigating it for independent family farmers who were, you know, who could start over and settle in the area from his area of the Dust Bowl or from California or wherever, you know, the Dust Bowl was a much larger area than just Oklahoma and Texas. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
You know, the drought of the 30s went all the way up to the Midwest. So there were a lot of people who lost their farms and their livelihoods in the 30s from the Depression or the Dust Bowl.
Yeah.
And so the idea of creating this Planned Promised Land by irrigating the Columbia Basin and providing cheap electrical power, you know, hydropower, was a way to provide a new opportunity for people that didn't have anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So Woody was behind that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a, yeah, I mean, it, when you put it that way, it definitely, you know, has the ring of for the greater good to it, you know?
Yeah. So that's why I make this point where you can't really be intellectually honest by saying dams are all good or are all bad.
Sure.
It's not
sure.
a black and white issue.
Yeah.
So the fact that, you know, this energy question of the 1930s was a real pivotal one for FDR and the New Deal, and the fact that, you know, they were using, you know, controlling natural resources for the benefit of people, which means lowering electrical rates for those who are getting yeah. ripped off by private power companies, and also providing electricity for rural people in eastern Oregon and eastern Washington who did not have electricity at all in 1935.
Yeah.
Imagine being a farmer.
And no way to get it.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's one of the songs, End of the Line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the power is great unless you're on the other side of the line. If the line doesn't go to you, you do not have electricity. So
yeah, and how do you take electricity over the Cascade Range?
Right.
Right? Like, that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But private power companies didn't see it to be cost-effective to extend their lines to rural people. So
right.
You know, that was sort of what the film was about, was the Columbia that this documentary was produced by the BPA to sort of show and demonstrate that, you know, more people could be served by extending power lines and using hydroelectricity
yeah.
to help farmers, and also, more importantly, the wives of farmers who had to cook with old wood stoves in 1935. I mean,
yeah.
people in the cities were using electricity and having a modern lifestyle.
They have electric stoves back then?
In the cities, yeah.
Yeah.
But if you were outside the power grid, you didn't
no,
have
yeah,
electricity.
Yeah,
so
totally.
The idea of the modern lifestyle for the wives and women of farmers was very, very appealing at the time.
Yeah,
to,
yeah.
You know, to get electricity to them to make their lives easier. So it was really about modernizing people's lifestyles.
Yeah. So what brought you into this? What gave you the idea to write this book? I mean, it sounds like a pretty daunting task to me.
Well, you know, the book came to me in a weird way. You know, I discovered the song cycle that Guthrie did for my radio show. So I did a radio show on KXP, and so I did a 3-hour show about this topic.
And you still do one, by the way. It's called Roadhouse.
Yeah, yeah. Every Wednesday. It's an American
it's a great
music
show.
Thank you.
Oh, I love your show. We turn it on for the kids on Wednesday nights, and they dance around and
cool.
stuff. They love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did the show, and it was all, you know, the show is really about the music, so you can't really do a whole lot of talking. You know, so
yeah.
it's like an economy yeah. of words when you do a radio show. So I always knew that this was a great story and would be a great book someday. You know, it's because there's so much interesting backstory and so much to the complexities of the era, the 1930s, and how Woody Guthrie got hired. And, you know, many people don't even know that there was a song cycle or know much about why Woody Guthrie was hired by the federal government, or that he even was in Portland for 1 month, right? So I did the radio show and always knew it'd be a great story. And then Sasquatch Books here in Seattle heard the radio show and offered me to write the book. So really the book came to me. You know, I guess it fell to me to tell the story in this, you know, in this.
Had you ever written anything like this before? I know that you write for American Standard Time, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But that's more of a blog.
Yeah, that's our music blog. So yeah. It's sort of an extension of the radio show where it's about American music and vintage uh-huh. lifestyle. So it's all about sort of culturally what goes with the music, you know?
Yeah, but a book is much different.
Way different.
Than writing a blog.
Man, I was psyched out, dude. I was like completely intimidated, but went to a cabin in the North Cascades.
You did?
It wasn't really a cabin. It was like a small house.
Yeah.
But it's nice to think of it as a cabin. And I holed up there, you know? And,
yeah.
And, you know, to be honest, I didn't think I could do it. And I knew the story, but I was able to kind of get the order of things and the chapters all lined up and
uh-huh.
get a good part in each chapter. But I was lucky to work with Dan Pearson, who's the co-writer.
Okay.
And he's a professional journalist. He works for the Seattle Weekly, and he really helped me flesh out each chapter into sort of a, you know, professional reading book.
Really?
Yeah, he was great.
Oh, my God. See, that? I mean, just thinking about writing a whole book scares me to the core. Like, if I had some sort of deadline like that, like, I would just break down.
It killed me.
Did it?
The self-hate was amazing.
Like how?
Well, I mean, it's a process. You don't, first of all, first-time writers don't know the process.
Right, right.
And then you get to a point where you just can't go any further, really. You know, each chapter for me would go so far, and then they would just kind of splinter off in these different directions, and you didn't really know how to tie them back together. So
yeah.
that's where Dan really came in helpful to really tie it together at the end and
uh-huh.
make sense of it, really. But until that time, we were just, I didn't know that writing was a collaborative process until I spoke to this editor who's not related to the book, but she told me, like, you know, Greg, not many people just write a book all by themselves. It's usually a collaboration with many people.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I didn't know that. And
well, especially something like this too, where it's a factual
right.
historical, a book on a historical figure.
And that's what really freaked me out the most is like, it's yeah. not just a book about, you know, the musician friend down the street or
right.
some guy
that you can talk
records.
To.
This is about the greatest folk icon ever.
Yeah.
Right
yeah.
next to Bob Dylan, there's not really a bigger topic in terms of you better get it right in terms
right.
of talking about Woody Guthrie, right? I mean,
yeah, yeah.
you can't be wrong about things. So that was intimidating.
Yeah, because there's historians out there.
There's
right?
a lot
that,
of,
like,
oh my God.
That, like, know about
there's
this.
There's a huge subject. Amount of academia around Woody Guthrie, which is
yeah.
ironically weird because Woody Guthrie tried his best to come off as a country rube, right?
Right.
He tried his best to,
right.
to act like he didn't know anything. That's sort of the beauty of him. He sort of, you know, masked his intelligence by maintaining this persona of just like a regular guy.
Right, right. So was there anything that kind of jumped out at you when you were doing your research on this? Like that surprised you?
Yeah, I think it was the time, the 1930s. What
uh-huh.
what an amazing decade. Because what we learned was, you know, it was the Depression and you know, it was all about reform but it was this sort of casting America in this new identity that was the most interesting thing. You know, a lot of people know about the recovery and relief programs that the government provided for people who are out of work. I mean, one mm-hmm. out of four mm-hmm. Americans was out of work. So
yeah.
there was a real psychological sort of effort on the government's part to instill confidence in people that it was going to be okay. You know, besides the fireside chats that FDR did on the radio,
right.
there's actually a program called the Federal One Project, which commissioned artists to create work to sort of celebrate what America really was and to sort of redefine what America was.
Yeah.
And part of that program was the Farm Security Administration, which they really sort of started the idea of photojournalism. So all these great photographers like Dorothea Lange and Arthur Rothstein and Walker Evans, they became famous by working on this project in which they would go out into the countryside and take photos of regular people and show them surviving.
Yeah.
The Depression.
Is that how we got some of those amazing photographs of the Dust Bowl? That's
exactly how it happened.
No kidding.
So they were all commissioned photographers.
No shit.
So they would be commissioned by the government, and then they would...
That would never happen today.
And then they would use those photographs in popular magazines, and so that was a way of introducing Americans to America.
Yeah.
At the time, mass media was just beginning. So
if you lived
in New York City, your idea of the rest of the country was limited on what you could see or read or whatever.
Right.
So the idea that those photographers took those amazing classic photographs and they were presented to Americans all across the country in magazines, they were being introduced and sort of, they were creating a sort of a sympathetic tone to what was happening across the country. People were suffering and yet mainly surviving with dignity and true grit.
Right.
And that was displayed in the photographs. So on top
that
of...
That is so cool.
On top of that, there's, you know, Frank Capra films like... You know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington about the common man, you know, fighting this sort of populist sort of agenda, you know. And then
all this would be commissioned by the government as well?
Well, you know, outside of that, there was like simultaneously sort of the same thing going on with artists who also wanted to sort of tap into this rebranding or this new identity of what they thought America was too. So you have sort of the government program going on with commissioned artists, and then alongside that you have people like John Steinbeck writing Grapes of Wrath.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that was just huge in sort of presenting the dilemma of migrants who were leaving the Dust Bowl and going to California and, you know, sort of being exploited and being ripped off. And so that book, Carl Sandburg's famous poem, Yes, the People, all these things were happening simultaneously in the 30s in this sort of, like I say, rebranding of what America really, really was.
You know,
as a change of from what it was before in the 20s, which was sort of this... You know, sort of a lot of urbane taste and sort of city living in the roaring 20s.
Yeah.
And that all crashed. And the
economy
crashed. So the 1930s is all about reform and sort of what America really is, which was sort of creating this new narrative with the common man being sort of the hero.
Right, right. Which is shares some parallels to what is going on right now, which is kind of crazy.
It's,
I mean, just hearing you talk about it,
it's really
frankly
amazing.
I'm impressed by your knowledge on the subject, and I find it fascinating. But yeah, I'm noticing some parallels to what's going on right now.
I mean,
but
the narrative is really the same.
Yeah, but nobody would know. There's such an outcry, like it's totally flipped, right? It's a role reversal basically from back then to now, because now nobody. I mean, there would be such a public outcry if the federal government was commissioning artists to go out and take pictures of the world or whatever.
Yeah, so the response was very different.
Yeah.
So the response back in the 1930s was what, you know, FDR and the New Deal did, and they understood that there was a need for this sort of psychological recovery, because everyone was, you know... in agreement that, you know, the speculation and rampant Wall Street, you know, shenanigans crashed the economy. There wasn't much
you know,
debate about that.
So in the
30s, FDR sort of had a, you know, he had a lot of support in terms of doing his programs, and he was reelected in 1936 with a huge margin. People were in favor of the New Deal. So the reaction nowadays is very much different, you know?
Yeah.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
That's so weird. I've never really
heard
it kind of compared, you know, living through this time, like I've never really thought of it in comparison to the era of the New Deal, which we're talking about today.
Well, nowadays people want to blame others for
the
mess that we're in.
Yeah.
Back then there wasn't so much the blame game, and it was pretty obvious what happened, and the way to get out of the mess in the old days in the 30s was to work together, to stick together, and to sort of unite in working your way out of it, which is why the working man, this common man, was the hero of that, you know, manufactured narrative, because that's what people believe would work, and, you know, I guess it did work.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty great, man. Would you like to read a section?
Well, I guess I would.
I'm
not really a writer until yesterday, but... so I'm not comfortable reading from a book, but I can try.
Yeah, yeah.
How about this part here?
Yeah,
this is,
sure.
This is the part where Woody Guthrie...
just a short selection of your choosing here, and then after that we'll go to our first or second musical break.
Yeah, so what happened was Woody Guthrie was suggested in a weird way by Alan Lomax to be the person that the BPA should hire for this role, right?
Yeah.
But... You know, he wasn't exactly offered the position. He was, you know, he's paid a visit in L.A. by a guy named Gunther von Fritsch, who was working with the producer of the film, and they were kind of checking Woody out to see if he would be appropriate. You know, did some photo shoot with him. And they sent him a letter saying, hey, it was great to see you in L.A. You know, we'll keep in touch about the job, you know, and we'll get back to you. And Woody at the time was really at a low point in his life. He was about in the worst condition he would ever find himself in terms of being unemployed and really sort of destitute with a wife and three children. And so he just took that as a opportunity. So he packed the family into the blue Pontiac and just drove up to Portland unannounced. So he drives from L.A.
So he just took it on a whim.
Just based on a hunch that, you know, he knew there was a film in the works and I guess he wanted the gig. So he just drive up there and get the gig. So
that's great.
I'll read here from chapter 6, which is titled Ramblin' Blues, Portland Town. Woody walked in wearing the khaki work shirt and matching work pants that he seemed to wear every day. He was bearded, unkempt, and reporting for a job that wasn't exactly his yet. It had been 12 days since the Bonneville Power Administration had sent him a letter stating that it was interested in hiring him to write songs for the agency and asking him to fill out paperwork to facilitate the hiring process. Instead, there he was, unannounced, holding a guitar and eating an apple at the BPA headquarters at 811 Northeast Oregon Street in Portland, with his wife and three kids waiting outside in the car. The blue Pontiac was now in even worse shape than it was when he used it to haul firewood in the Sierra Nevadas. That's where he was before he actually left. He went from L.A. to this place to chop wood in the Sierra Nevadas. Guthrie had busted out a window when he locked the keys inside. The upholstery was ripped, and the vehicle looked generally lived in. His hobo beatnik style wasn't exactly what employees at the government agency were used to seeing. The BPA, just 4 years old at that time, was made up of engineers and bureaucrats. The only people who could have any use for a dusty folk singer were in the public information office, the head of which soon fetched Woody and shepherded him to his desk. Stephen Kahn had heard of Woody Guthrie, but had never heard his music, let alone met the man. He'd gotten his name from Alan Lomax, who recommended Guthrie for Kahn's documentary project with a flow of superlatives over the phone from D.C. Quote, the idea that Woody would actually get a job writing ballads was just an unconceivable stroke. I felt like shouting over the telephone line. It was a laughing conversation all the way. I can remember the delight and sense of triumph I felt that Woody would get a chance to do this, unquote, Lomax said. The job Lomax recommended Guthrie for was a year-long gig to be an actor, narrator, and singer in the documentary The Columbia, America's Greatest Power Stream. That was still the job description when Gunther von Fritsch visited Guthrie to take some photos in L.A. It was even the job description mentioned in the letter BPA sent to Woody on the first day of May, quote, narrator, actor, $3,200 per annum. However, the May 1st letter also stated that the Department of Interior in Washington, D.C. needed to approve the one-year contract. That con sense from the start could be a problem. The film's budget was tenuous and war was looming. Then there was Woody's background. Even though Khan was clearly a liberal himself and an activist for public power, hiring another activist who wrote columns for a communist newspaper, a known agitator and sometimes radical, was a whole other deal. Still, while Khan hadn't officially offered Guthrie a job in the first place, now that he was standing in front of him, he didn't want to let an opportunity pass. Quote, "He had his guitar and I said, 'Play me something,' Khan recalled. And I listened and I said, 'Woody, I think you have the common touch.'" Unquote. The solution Khan came up right then and there was an emergency appointment for 1 month. Such an appointment required approval only from within the agency, the BPA's administrator, Paul Raver. Khan set up an impromptu audition with the boss. Raver had taken over the BPA shortly after J.D. Ross's untimely death in 1939. A gaunt, bespectacled former Northwest University professor, Raver wasn't the enthusiastic public power advocate that Ross had been. He considered it inappropriate, for example, for the agency to get too involved in the local PUD elections. Perhaps anticipating Raver's conservative tendencies and fearing that Woody might start spouting ideology, Khan gave the singer a warning. Quote, "Just play your guitar and sing your songs," he said. "If you talk, you'll lose the battle."
The book is called 26 Songs in 30 Days by Greg Vandy, and we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears.
I've been riding them fast rattlers, I thought you knowed. I've been riding them flat wheelers way down the road. I've been riding them dead enders, blind passengers kicking up cinders. I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. Well, I've been hitting some hard rock mining, I thought you knowed. I've been leaning on a pressure drill way down the road. Hammer flying, air hose sucking, 6 foot of mud and a show been a mucking, and I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. Well, I've been hitting some hard harvesting, I thought you knowed. North Dakota to Kansas City, way down the road. Cutting out wheat and stacking out hay and trying to make about a dollar a day, and I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. I've been working at Pittsburgh Steel, I thought you knowed. I've been pouring red hot slag way down the road. I've been blasting, I've been firing, and I've been pouring red hot iron, and I've been having some hard traveling, Lord. Well, I've been laying in a hard rock jail, I thought you knowed. I've been laying out 90 days way down the road. An old judge has said to me it's 90 days for vagrancy, and I've been hitting some hard traveling, Lord.
So, we had a conversation one time at Timberfest about nerves. Because I was telling you, we were both emceeing different parts of the festival like that.
Yeah.
And like that's you were telling
night,
me.
That's the night that I lost my glasses.
Yeah, that's
and I had
right.
to wear sunglasses at night.
That's right.
Because they were prescription sunglasses.
Yeah.
And I couldn't see without them. So I was that guy.
You were that guy.
At night wearing sunglasses.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
had to MC.
And then had to MC. And you were telling me that you get really nervous.
Yeah.
Doing that kind of stuff.
It sucks.
And that you get nervous doing your radio show, which blew me away. Absolutely blew me away. Do you still get nervous doing the radio
yeah,
show?
Yeah, you know, the thing about the radio show is it's live. You know, it'd
yeah.
be great if it was, like, pre-recorded. And
but see, here's the thing is, like, you're on the radio. You're on KEXP,
yeah.
man.
Yeah.
Like, you know, every time. So I talked to Troy
we're
about
all,
this.
We're all untrained. We didn't go to broadcasting school.
We're
just nerds with records who go on the radio and they, you know, there's the mic, talk on it. You know,
yeah,
it's not
yeah.
like we've been trained to do that. None of the people there have been trained.
Right. Right. But it just blew me away and it made me feel better.
Well, I'm glad to do that for you.
Because
I feel like I'm here for you.
Because I offered you. I think I even offered you. Like I was like, well, I've got beta blockers.
I've tried this.
Did you?
Yeah.
They were not work for you?
I don't know. It's just kind of like, you know, it's all like, it's just psychological, right?
Oh, and yeah.
Mind never
yeah,
matter.
For sure. For sure.
I don't really get nervous doing the show, the radio show, but, you know, I guess you just get nervous if you think you might fuck up, basically, you know.
Right, right.
You're just afraid of fucking up.
Well, that's it. Yeah, that's what everybody is. I'm afraid my body's going to fuck up on the beach. That's why I don't take my shirt off. You know? That's the whole thing.
That's the whole thing. So how did you get in? How did you get into music, man? Like, you are arguably very into music and very into Americana.
Yeah.
How did that all start? Where does that stem from?
I don't call it Americana.
I know you do.
Glad you said that.
Okay. Why?
I start find there. I find Americana to be very white.
Okay.
And when I say American music, I'm incorporating all the different traditions of American music.
Blues, folk,
gospel, folk.
Everything. Okay.
So if I said, you know, did anyone ever say when they're talking about Muddy Waters, there's Muddy Waters, there's some fine Americana for you? No,
never.
They don't.
No,
yeah.
They say so blues. Yeah.
Americana just reeks of whiteness to me.
Okay. Okay. I get that.
But how I got into music, geez, like you, I guess. Just, you know.
Were your parents really into it? Like a lot of music going on in the house?
There's never an instrument in the house. I've never learned how to play an instrument because my parents, I mean, yeah, I love them, right? But they certainly didn't encourage anything creative at all.
Not even listening to it a lot?
I just know more than average, you know. But my brother, my brother Mark was really, and I mentioned him in the book, he was really sort of my, I guess, catalyst because he really, we listened to American Top 40. This is like the 70s. And, you know, the early 70s was a great time for music. And it was a time where you could have a pop song that was a little bit of country, rock and roll, gospel.
Yeah.
All in one song. Like you take a song like Joe South's Walk a Mile in My Shoes. That's a rock and roll song. It's a gospel song. It's a country song.
Yeah.
All mixed into one. So that was acceptable in the early 70s, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All those traditional revival forms were coming together to where you could make music that touched upon all those traditional sort of genres. So I guess I grew up with that, and that sort of reflects on my show now. But, you know, I just sort of like the rabbit hole, right? You know, you discover something on top of the ground, and you suddenly find yourself in this long, deep rabbit hole when you sort of follow the, you know, the breadcrumbs of how songs get made and what artists created other artists and what people were in what bands. And
I'm definitely getting that impression from you. You are the guy who goes deep.
Yeah. It's so interesting.
Yeah. What did you, did you go to school? Did you go to college?
Yeah, I tried.
Yeah?
I did. Yeah, I yes. Yeah, school sucked though, you know, I mean.
Yeah, did you get a degree?
Who wants to read what they want you to read, right? I mean,
oh, nobody.
I wish I could go to school now because that'd be great. But at the time, I was interested in what I wanted to learn about. Which I was more interested in learning about how to hang out and, you know, the sort of social. You know, I learned about being social in college. I didn't learn really about the books.
That's for sure. That's for sure. I was put on academic probation my first year in college. Yeah, it was bad. Yeah. I didn't even tell my parents. My dad just relayed this story again to me just a couple days ago. And he was like, you remember that day when I called you up and asked you how school was going and you said, ah, Dad, it's going great. Classes are going good. I'm getting all my work done. And then I brought up the fact that, this is my dad talking, and then I brought up the fact that we got a letter in the mail from the school saying that you were not doing well and you were put on academic probation. Because remember, Aaron, we pay the bills.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, shit.
So I think your dad learned that you were not doing well in school and that you were a liar.
Yeah, all at the same time. He knew that already. He knew that one.
Yeah, I really want to go back to Fairhaven. I went to Western.
Yeah?
And I went to Fairhaven for a bit, and I really want to go back
there. Up in Bellingham.
Yeah, great place to go to school. I highly recommend any Seattle kid.
I went to Central. You and I are mortal enemies.
Well, same thing. You know, if you're a Seattle kid, recommend you going to another school that's close enough to home, but yet you're doing your own thing. Bellingham's a great thing, a great place for that. And so really want to go back there and present my book up there.
Yeah, yeah. That'd be cool,
There's
man.
There's actually a book reading on May 17th at either Village Books or the Watkins Museum.
Now, are you nervous about that?
No, I'm not nervous about that because I feel like when I'm talking with people, like in a Q&A situation, I love that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
You want some beta blockers? I'm here for you, man.
Okay.
When Greg got into the backyard, he sat down and he was like, you know,
what are we going to talk about? And I got the sense that you were a little bit nervous that I was going to try to dig too deep or something. Were you nervous about that?
No, and I'm not even that nervous. I'm just saying that, you know, the book has so much context that there's no short story. Like, you know, I fail.
Well, no, it is a thick, sturdy book, man.
Yeah, but I guess I just sort of it's hard for me to tell a short story.
Yeah,
my stories are all long because I feel like context is important.
Well, sure.
How are you going to understand something fully unless you know the complete entire context of it?
Well, and you've kind of gone through the gauntlet with this book too.
Yeah.
Like doing television spots and that kind of stuff, like really kind of, and this is not supposed to be or sound bad, but it's a little bit superficial, right? Because it's very, very short clips of you talking about, you know, a very involved process.
New Day Northwest, man.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say names.
I was on that show today and that was great because, you know, it's New Day Northwest. Every housewife and mother in the area was watching that, and it was great. But it's like very, you know, talk about surface, which is fine by me.
Yeah. But does that bug you at all? Like that? Like
no, it doesn't.
It's just kind of scratching the surface of what the book really is.
No, it doesn't at all. I mean, you know, they showed the picture of the cover on the TV, so that's fantastic. But, you know, I was asked on a different show today about what's your favorite song? You know, it's 26 songs. What's your favorite one?
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't think of it. I was like, what?
Could you not think of any one?
I thought of one, but it wasn't the one.
Right, right.
The favorite song is Pastures of Plenty. Easy. I mean, that's just like the greatest folk song ever written, and it happens to be a Columbia River song.
Yeah.
So the fact that I couldn't remember that, I was like, well, you idiot, right? Because, I mean, it is... You know, I really think it's one of the best folk songs I've ever written, and it's about the migrant experience from leaving the Dust Bowl and, you know, the experience.
And making their way over.
And, well, going to California and just sort of, how corrupt the situation was for people to leave the Dust Bowl and go to California, and just the difficulties of being a migrant. I mean, hello, right? It's tough. It's hard traveling, as Woody would say. So, but the idea that this rhetoric that they use, you know, the planned promised land, meaning the Columbia Basin. So that is the pasture of plenty. So the song that's nationally famously, you know, one of Guthrie's greatest songs is about the Columbia Basin.
Yeah.
And not many people know that. So that's clearly my favorite song because it's so cool. Right? Who knew, right? So
yeah. But, you know, you get put on the spot. You can't really think of stuff like that. I mean, it's just, you know.
Yeah. So I guess I'm more nervous about, like, what are the questions going to be so I can prepare myself to answer them, right?
Sure. Yeah. I get people like that sometimes on the show, like where the PR person will email me in advance and say, hey, so what kind of questions are you guys going to ask? I say, well, we don't know. We just start. Like, that's just it. Like, it's a conversation. It's not really question-answer kind of thing. And then you get this, like, week-long pause from the PR, the publicist, going, wait a minute, what is this?
Yeah.
Do you ever have guests on your show?
Yeah.
Do you?
I do, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you have to book that stuff yourself?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. It's actually, having a guest or doing it in studio is really actually a lot of legwork, and so
sometimes
people think that it's just so easy. I'll just come on your show, and it's like, well, it's a bit
more than that,
and I have to do a lot more work if I'm going to do that. Because
you
know, I like just to cruise up there, get there, and do the show, and leave, and you know, just that's fun for me. But it's also fun having guests. I'm just trying to say that there's more to having a guest.
Well, especially when you guys, I mean, you know, in an actual radio studio, it's not like it's in your backyard. You can do it.
Exactly.
You know, like what I do here.
Yeah.
It's very simple for me to come home from my day job and say, oh, Greg Vandy's coming over at 4:30. Okay, I'll go fire up the computer. We'll have things set up. Yeah. I won't read his book, and then he'll come over and I'll tell him.
Yeah, it was easy for you. Wow, this is so easy.
And you had to drive all the way up here, so I thank you for that.
I'm glad to be here.
Good. So how did you get into radio, man? How did that whole thing happen?
Oh, God, great story. A great question, Aaron. Thank you. I got into radio by bartending at Hattie's Hat Restaurant. I was a bartender at Hattie's Hat.
Yeah.
Remember Hattie's?
Yeah.
Still there, of course.
Still there, but, yeah. You know, there's a wonderful place.
There's a certain sweet spot back in the day when it was transitioning from, you know, an alcoholic fisherman bar to a hipster place. And so there was like this transition where the two groups would mingle. And this was like the late 90s. And so I bartended there. And Don Slack, his radio show, Swingin' Doors, is a country show. It's on Thursday nights, still is one of the best shows.
Is that one of the longest running shows on the station?
Could be.
It's got to be,
you know,
right?
Well, Shake the Shack is longer, I think.
Oh, Shake the Shack. Okay. Yeah.
But Don would do a show, and I would record his radio show at home on my cassette deck.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was learning about country music by listening to his show and by reading No Depression magazine. That's how I learned about country music.
Yeah.
And so I would hear Don's show, and I would edit my master cassette tape that bounced down my favorite songs to a new cassette tape and have like a kind of a greatest hits cassette tape.
Yeah.
And then I would go into Hattie's and I'd bartend.
Yeah.
And there was a cassette player there. I'd put in this tape of Don's like greatest hits and I'd play it. Because at the time Hattie's was like kind of like, it was a pre-funk for all the shows at the Tractor. So
sure,
it was like an alt country show.
Yeah.
At the Tractor, I would play the appropriate music. I'd play Don's greatest hits.
Yeah.
And so one time I didn't even know Don. And one time Don came in there and he was a margarita drinker, still is, no salt. And he came in there and he's like in the back and he's like, "Hey, what is this music?" And I was like, "Oh, here, let me show you." So I went back and I grabbed the cassette tape and thankfully and you know, I was smart enough to label the cassette tape with the Sharpie, and I said, you know, Swingin' Doors, greatest hits. And then I showed him the cassette tape, and he was like, "Oh, that's cool." He's like flattered, you know?
Yeah.
And
so did you know who he was?
Yeah, kind of a little bit. Not really.
You knew what he looked like, though. Like,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't know him. So so then he thought that was cool. So obviously there was like some rare records that only he had that was on. So he's kind of wondering, like, how is this song showing up here at Hattie's?
Yeah.
So then after that, he would come in, and I got to know him, and I'd pour him a drink, and I'd give him his margarita, no salt, and I'd put it down there in the bar, and I'd kind of lean on my elbow and get close to him and say, "You know, Don, you know, you're doing that Wednesday show, and you're doing the Thursday show." At the time, the Wednesday show, the guy had left, so Don was sort of filling in, doing two shows a week.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "It's not really fair for you or the audience to do two shows in a row like that, and, you know, I think I should do the Wednesday show." And he would laugh. And then he would just come in there every week, and I'd say the same thing. And then finally he said, "Well, just give me a demo." And to his credit, like, I gave a lot of people demos over my life to do a DJ gig or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I gave Don the demo, and I pretty much programmed the show by putting some songs on a cassette tape with KXP underwriting, like, between the songs, so it would kind of play, like,
so
the show would actually sound.
Right.
And then I gave Don the tape, and he actually listened to it. And responded and said, "Hey, you want to do the show?"
That's great, said, man.
Yeah.
So that's so cool.
That's how it happened.
So
before that, I did a show at KXP. No, I'm sorry. Jesus. KUGS.
Okay.
In Bellingham for college.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so
okay.
That's how I began.
So you did have some sort experience. Of like experience doing it.
I did.
I did the same. I went to the meeting, to the initial meeting at Central Washington University, to do the radio program there. And after that meeting, when I realized that they're not going to give me a show right off the bat, I was like, "Fuck this, I'm out of here."
Totally you. Oh, I'm the same way. I'm that way to this day. Like, if I can't be doing something great right away. I don't want to do it. Yeah, I can't work my way up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you did. I mean, you did it with this book, man. This is a feat, dude. Like, I am really, really impressed. I mean, even just like listening to you do the reading a little bit ago, and just looking at the final product, it's a beautiful book.
Yeah, thanks, man. I'm happy with it. And one of the things that is great about the book is we were able to work with Woody Guthrie's publisher, TRO, and the Woody Guthrie family. We were able to publish as a photograph 11 of Woody Guthrie's hand-typed song manuscripts, meaning Woody would type out the lyrics onto a sheet of paper and turn them in. And so we have those original manuscripts.
That's pretty cool, man.
Photographs.
Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff in here, a lot of great photos. I can't wait to crack into this and do some reading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, man. Well, Greg, I know you got to get going. Can we do one more selection of,
yeah,
of
man,
reading to,
of course,
to close this whole thing?
Yeah,
out?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right.
Try to read this for you. What part do you want?
I don't know. Just pick something that kind of interests you and
okay.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's hear it,
this
man.
This is the last chapter. It's called Talk in Columbia. And it sort of wraps up the entire book. So I'll start there. And today, the 26 songs Woody Guthrie wrote for the Bonneville Power Administration remain an accomplishment in terms of songwriting, but they ultimately stand the test of time as one of Woody's finest bodies of work. A song cycle that was unusually focused and extremely inspiring, there's no doubt that Pastures of Plenty, Grand Coulee Dam, and Roll on Columbia have outlived their usefulness in promoting the Columbia River projects, but they live on in the pantheon of American folk music. The Columbia River songs have appreciated in time in another way as well. It is our assertion that the 26 songs are a direct response to Woody's earlier and much more celebrated Dust Bowl ballads. In their optimism, the songs reflect the hope of a nation emerging from a decade of hard times, environmental calamity, and displacement by embracing bold public works projects and the idea of tangibly helping common people. In his Columbia River songs, he conveyed a sense that something better was coming, that the planned, quote, the planned promised land in the Pacific Northwest was indeed a solution to the Dust Bowl crisis. Quote, we're talking about a certain time in American history, the Depression, hard times, coming out of it a bit, but not quite solvent, said Studs Terkel, the Chicago writer and Woody's friend. Quote, but at the same time, there was kind of an optimistic spirit, like a light at the end of the tunnel. You felt something popping, and Woody caught that spirit.
Greg Vandy, thank you so much for joining me this week, man. That was great.
It was fun, Aaron. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. I'm glad you could come up.
Me too.
Yeah.
Let's hang out.
It's good to see you. Well, now you got a baby, man. We can do like a baby thing.
Yeah. Maybe I'll see you at the Woody Guthrie Day, the 75th anniversary celebration of Woody Guthrie at the Grand Coulee Dam site.
Oh.
The first time Guthrie will ever be recognized there for his contribution to all this.
That's amazing.
And that's Saturday, May 28th of Memorial Day.
All right. All right. Yeah. And our buddy, our mutual friend, Kevin Sir, is helping you put that thing
absolutely
on.
Artist Home is behind producing the thing. And it's been great fun. And it's a free event. It's a very family-friendly event. It's a great road trip to go out there.
And what's the date again?
Saturday, May 28th.
May 28th. All right. Well, that's great, man. At Grand Coulee Dam. That's super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude.
You've been there before?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm Washingtonian, man.
Many Seattleites have never been out there.
I know, and it's weird.
And it's just an amazing, beautiful area.
It's enormous.
Kind of, it's like you're in Utah or something.
Yeah,
you're
in
Arizona. So it's just a beautiful climate. And the road trip out there is just amazing. You go along, you know, Highway 155 along all those, you know, it was Banks Lake, and all those lakes are diverted water from the Columbia River.
Yeah.
Those were dry coulees.
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, those are reservoirs for that huge irrigation system that sends water from Grand Coulee all the way to the Columbia Basin, which makes it green.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Yeah. Well, Greg Vandy, once again, thank you so much for coming, man.
Thanks.
It's been a real pleasure.
Great to be here.
Yeah. Well, all right, Greg Vandy, everybody. His book, 26 Songs in 30 Days, is available now. Go to, go to SasquatchBooks.com and get yourself a copy, or you can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, and Powell's Books, man, amongst many, many, many other places, I'm sure. Like I said, I haven't made it all the way through the book because we still got a lot of shit happening in this little rodent family. We had a 5-year-old's birthday party today. 5-year-old's birthday party. Tatum. Little Tatum Olivia Roden turned 5 earlier this last week. And we had her birthday party this weekend. I want to actually read something for you because I think I put it more concisely to how I would want to say this. Tatum was born premature, and she had a very, very rough start to her life.
It was probably the roughest time. Me and her mother have ever had the roughest 2 months, because Lil Tatum was in the hospital for 2 months, the first 2 months of her life, not able to breathe by herself, and was fairly close to death. And we just can't. It's just amazing. I'm at a loss for words here. It's just amazing to see this wonderful little ball of joy and amazement grow to be 5 years old after living through such, you know, a hellish time at the beginning of her life. And this is what I wrote on Facebook. I want to read it for you too. 5 years ago today, this little scamp came into our lives. It would prove to be one of the hardest couple of months both me and my wife had ever lived through. It was so hard to watch something so new, so small, and a person we cared so much for be so close to death at her very beginning. But little Tatum fought back, and after 5 years has accomplished so much. She has become a beacon of positivity and light in our lives, especially as we have entered yet another tumultuous time in our little family that we must navigate through. 5 years old. They always say it goes so fast, and they are right. I can't wait for the next 50. Happy birthday, Tatum Olivia Roden. I love you. I love you. You can find out more about the Air Raid podcast by going to our website at www.air-raid.net. And you can also subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you do, please take a moment to rate the show. We're also available on the Stitcher, TuneIn, and Cairo radio apps. Or just visit our website to subscribe directly to our RSS feed. We're also available on Spreaker at Spreaker.com. Go and check that out. Keep in touch by liking our Facebook page at facebook.com/TheAirRaid Podcast. Our Twitter handle is at AirRaidNet. You can follow us there as well. Or email me directly if you'd like to get in touch at aaron@air-raid.net. And remember to take the pledge, folks. Take the pledge to tell somebody about this show. Tell your friends, your mother, your sister, your brother, your cousins. Even take your fathers. We'll take your fathers, okay? Sign them up while they aren't looking. Talk about this show, bring it up in conversation, spread the word. And if you see our stuff pop up on Facebook, please give it a little like, even though you don't want to listen, if you don't want to listen to the episode, just give it a little like, because if you do that, the algorithm works like this. You touch it, other people see it, okay? So that's how it works. That's how you can help. That's easy, man. It's easy. It's a one-click thing. And that's taking the pledge, right? Spreading the word about the Air Raid podcast. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening this week. We had a great time with you. And we hope you guys have a good week. Be safe, be sane, and we'll see you on the other side. This song that we're going to go out with today is called Passions Aplenty by Woody Guthrie. The book by Greg Vandy, 20 songs or 26 songs in 30 days, available now. Go get your copy. And listen to Greg's show on KEXP, The Roadhouse. It's amazing. I know you guys will really dig it. All right. Thank you so much for listening this week. We love you guys. Peace. Have a good one.
California and Arizona, I make all your crops. And it's north up to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine to set on your table your light sparkling wine. Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground, from that Grand Coulee Dam where the water runs down. Ever stayed in this union, us migrants have been. We'll work in this fight and we'll fight till we win. Well, it's always we ramble, that river and I, all along your green valley I'll work till I die. My land I'll defend with my life if it be, 'cause my pastures of plenty must always be free.